and welcome to Conversations with the Legal Academy, a podcast from the University of Arkansas School of Law. My name is Dorinda Sharp.
And I'm Colin Hesse. On this episode, Daniel Rodriguez, the Harold Washington Professor and Dean at Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law, talks with Dorinda about his research. He was on campus to present Federalism During and After Trump, the spring 2018 Hartman Hutz Lecture in Law and Liberal Arts.
We hope you enjoy the conversation. Hi, Dean Rodriguez. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
You're here to do a Hartman Hutz Lecture in Law and Liberal Arts. So your title is Federalism During and After Trump. Pretty provocative. Why don't you tell us about what you're going to talk about?
Sure. So I'm long been interested in the intersection of law and public policy, ranging from current events, how we think about governance in our modern pluralistic society. Federalism, of course, is one element of that. It's maybe a lawyerly or legalistic title to give to the complex reality that states interact with the federal government, interact with local governments. What the election of Donald Trump does, I'm neither the first nor perhaps the 101st person to make the following observation. What the election of President Trump does is upends in many important ways our understandings of not only the relationship between a very strong and what I will argue in my lecture, a fairly authoritarian approach to governance on the part of the president and other institutions, but in particular, it upends the potentially upends the traditional balance of power among the national government and the state governments. And I'm going to talk about that from a from a big picture perspective, but in particular, and hopefully of interest to the community, with focus on particular examples, subject matters, and disputes and controversies that are raging around the country.
Everything from, I assume, sanctuary cities to medical marijuana, or just plain. So one of the things that I ran into helping to promote your talk is I wrote something about sovereign governments, meaning national, states, municipal. And every time someone read that, they assumed it was referring to various national governments on an international scale. What do you think it is that keeps people from remembering that all of our governments in the United States are sovereign?
I think the focus in this is certainly characteristic of everyone from law students here and elsewhere to ordinary citizens in many ways. Think of the national government as the most central, important governmental institution in their lives. It is what brings us together as the United States of America. We lavish attention, and quite rightly, on the election of the president and everything leading up to that. We think of the main decision makers in our society as being at the national government level, and there's an important truth to that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we fought a revolution and a civil war, not to mention everything since, to preserve the identity of we the people as a nation. And the national government, of course, acts on behalf of we the people. Having said all that, as your question illustrates, much of what impacts our day-to-day lives as citizens, much of what we're involved in, and my students and graduates are involved in the practice of law, particularly public law, law and government, involves decisions made at the state level by the 50 states, which are sovereign in just the sense I take it you mean, which is they were part of the union that defined the United States. And although there have been more states added to the union, that fundamental principle hasn't changed. And last but certainly not least, many, many decisions are made on the local level. Land use policy, environmental policy, tax policy, so many aspects of the regulation that affects our lives are made below the level of the national government. So we we ignore the states and the localities sort of at our peril if we really want to understand what's going on.
Sometimes I think mayors are the most powerful public figures. I mean, granted, it's a narrow area of power, but where they're in charge, they're really in charge.
Absolutely.
So you said you had been interested in this topic for a long time. What led you to your interest?
It's interesting. You know, when I began my teaching career, which I did about a quarter century ago, and was developing a portfolio of teaching subjects in the law school, UC Berkeley is where I began my academic career, and also developing subjects of academic study, I really was, from that beginning of my career, thinking deeply about the relationship between private ordering, sort of individual liberty and decision making, and the role of government. So when I get asked the question, well, so what is your subject matter expertise, or what are the areas that you're interested in? I always say public law, and I define that in the traditional way as understanding the law and government. The way in which the law regulates governance between individuals and the state, sort of capital S. From that sort of broad principle, I became and still remain very interested in the dynamics of interinstitutional conflicts, struggles, controversies, and the like. Long before President Trump came on the scene, which is, as you note, the topic of my lecture today, I've been interested in how we think about decisions made at the local level, whether it's in a state or in a community, municipality, and the impact made by the federal government.
The president has just put a different lens on it, as he has in so many areas, but he's made a different illustration to dig into, I assume.
Well, that's right, and you know, there's so much to talk about, and I have, and certainly I'm going to only be able to touch on a few of these themes, but I just want to just respond to this. It's the he is important. I mean, we're talking about a larger than life personality, right? President of the United States, right. And not just any president, but Donald Trump. But it's not just the he that's the focus and ought to be the focus of our interest. It's the movement that his election really targeted and began. And so part of my conversation this afternoon will be federalism after Trump. And there will be an after Trump. When it exactly that is remains to be seen. But after that, the question really is what the impact and the effect of this movement that he was so responsible for creating, he and his you know, allies, does to the dynamic relationship between the presidency and Congress and between the national government and state governments. We get all of us do, I'm no exception, wrapped up in, oh my God, what the heck did he do today? Yeah. And what are the, you know, what's the latest controversy? We sometimes forget that we're you know, this republic's been around for more than two centuries. God willing, it'll continue, and we'll be making important public choices. So how the impact of one presidency, this rather unusual and unexpected presidency, what the impact will be about how we think about governance in the, you know, in the coming years and decades is frankly, to me, the most important topic, even more than what we do about one or another policy kerfuffle.
Mm-hmm. We're watching a pendulum swing and wondering how far it's going to swing out before it starts swinging back.
Well, that's true. There's certainly many who regard political movements at the national level, election of presidencies, as essentially cyclical in the sense of, so we've, you know, that Trump's election, President Trump's election, in some sense is a reaction to President Obama, and that we'll see a reaction to President Trump. I'm a little more skeptical about this kind of pendulum or cyclical idea. I actually think that so many aspects of our political process, our constitutional process, can become hardwired, can become sticky. And as they become sticky, they create institutions that are hard to change. So I'll just give you one example. Much of there is now, after the election of 2016, the vast majority of the governors in the United States are Republicans. I think the number is about 32. So a substantial majority. Maybe it's even higher than that. It's in the 30s. A substantial majority of the states are under Republican control in the state legislature, and there's double digits number of states that are veto-proof majorities. Now, one could say, well, that's true now, but it was different 20 years ago. It's going to be different 5 years from now. But that didn't happen by accident. That happened by a combination of decisions that involved the apportionment of state legislatures. It involved political movements like the election of Trump. It involved who gets appointed to the Supreme Court, campaign financing. So decisions like that, whether you love that or hate that, or are agnostic, can become sticky because of choices made throughout the political process. That's a long way of saying maybe it's cyclical and maybe the pendulum will swing back in some ways, but I wouldn't necessarily count on it.
One of the things I like to delve into when we have guest scholars on campus is what led you into academics as opposed to practicing law?
Mm-hmm. You know, a combination of three factors. My own interests developed really when I was in law school in thinking about a career that would involve teaching and scholarship, something I really never anticipated. Certainly didn't have a background in as a first-generation college graduate. It wasn't like I had resort to a lot of scholarly mentors. So some of it was my own interest. Second was having important mentors in law school. I was at the Harvard Law School, and to my surprise and really gratitude, some in law school, some of my professors raised that with me. They said, you know, you might actually have some real talents in this regard, and were very, very important, as I try to be at this stage of my career. And the third is luck and fortuity. in my case, in particular, I was recruited to join the faculty at University of California, Berkeley Law School really early on, I mean, not long after I was a graduate from law school. If that hadn't happened, if instead I wasn't recruited and it was more a question of applying, then I might have, I think I would have ended up in academia. I love it. I'd like to think that that was my path, but I might have done some different things along the way. So when I'm, as I often am, in the position of advising students who might think of academic careers or might think of that, I certainly advise them to do something somewhat different than what I did, which is to gain more of a range of experience so that they can really know what they want by the time they go into it's what's the old saying, do as I say, not what I do. But having said all that, I have no regrets. I became an academic at a very early age, and never looked back. Really thought that was thought and continue to think that was the right career for me.
Well, you spent most of your, the way I understand it, you spent most of your professional career in California and then moved to Northwestern. So from California to Chicago.
Texas, in between.
Oh, okay.
I spent 5 years on the faculty. I did spend most of my formative years, my life, all the way through college in California, and in particular in Southern California, where I grew up, Long Beach, California. After law school, I hightailed it back to California, where I stayed for many, many years. First as a judicial law clerk, then at two wonderful law schools, Berkeley and at San Diego. When I stepped down from the deanship at San Diego, my wife and I really thought at the time, you know, it wouldn't kill us to actually see another part of the country. We love California, we're Californians, but really so we found our way to Texas, to Austin, Texas, where we were for nearly 5 years until I was recruited to be the dean at Northwestern in Chicago.
What drew you to Northwestern?
You know, what drew me to Northwestern, I wasn't looking to sort of get back into academic administration, although I certainly enjoyed and my time, and I believe prospered during my time at San Diego. What drew me to Northwestern was the opportunity to lead a terrific world-class law school at a fabulous research university in a part of the country that, as your question indicates, I had no particular connection to other than as a tourist, and to do so, that is to lead that school as dean during a time of tremendous change, dynamic change, fascinating change in the legal profession, and in the provision of legal services. And if I sound like an evangelist in that way, it's because I really feel that way. I felt that just the combination of so many factors, including, frankly, the meltdown in the economy, the crash, the role of technology, just a number of factors were making legal education a more complicated endeavor. It made leading a law school, even a relatively speaking, a wealthy law school like Northwestern, facing significant challenges. And maybe out of hubris or a taste for adventure, I thought, this is a really good time to get more deeply back involved in academic leadership. It was a good time in my life and good time in my career. And Northwestern seemed then and to be an ideal place to do that.
So this is your last year as dean.
It is.
Are you looking forward to getting back into the classroom?
Very much. So in the course of my career, as I just recently recollected, I've spent about half of my career in academic administration leading to law schools. At the end of this time, it'll be 6.5 years I will have been at Northwestern. And about half of my time in as a full-time academic, not as a dean. So that just happened that way. So while I have zero regrets about the twists and turns that my career has taken, I very much look forward to becoming re-engaged in normal academic life with an important asterisk, normal academic life, but working on some of the issues and some of the challenges that I was involved in academic leadership. I'm happy to talk more about them, but I mean, I feel like because I was dean and because I was dean at Northwestern the time I was in, I've developed some other interests that I hope to continue, obviously wearing a different hat.
I'm sure it gives you a completely different perspective as a faculty member.
Well, I hope so. I don't know, because I don't know the thought experiment if I hadn't been
right.
Dean. But I felt when I got to Texas, I'll just give you an example of this. I felt that when I had arrived at the University of Texas as a faculty member following a deanship, I certainly had an appreciation for the challenges that the students were facing. I had was in a leadership role with respect to student career choices, the anxieties about student debt, which has been a big preoccupation of mine, the way in which they were entering a field that's been changed and affected by technology. I had a sense of that as a full-time academic, but I didn't have the wider perspective that I gained from leading the law school. I also, maybe this is a small point in the grand scheme of things, but I have much more sympathy to what our administrators at the university level and the law school level have to deal with,
right?
With respect to faculty members, and I try to aspire to be as low maintenance as I can as a faculty member, because I know deans appreciate that.
Getting back into the classroom makes me wonder what advice you might have for current students, people who are in law school right now, and what you, out of your experience, might tell them. Whether it's career advice, how to be successful in their studies,
sure.
Any of the above?
Happy to. So one thing, advice I like to give to prospective law students, so I'll start there, is advice that I didn't particularly get, and frankly wasn't that common when I started law school, which is if you can manage to get some real-world experience between the time you graduate from college and the time you go to law school, that's terrific. Not everybody can, not everybody wants to, but we're all such in a hurry. And I find at Northwestern, where more than 90% of our entering class has a work experience, has a gap of time between the time they graduate from college and the time they begin, for all sorts of reasons, that's beneficial. Now, once they come to law school, well, it would be a long list, but let me just hit what I believe are the highlights. I think students should think about managing their careers and think about their careers really from the very beginning of their time in law school. I don't mean that they should be preoccupied with, or in looking for their first job. They should be focused on their studies and focused on the tasks before them. But behaving more entrepreneurially, learning what sometimes are called the soft skills, developing the ability to communicate effectively. I don't just mean legal writing, but I mean communicate effectively in responsible use of social media and networking and developing leadership skills are very important. Law schools historically don't emphasize that, although they're starting to change. They say, we're teaching you the law, we're teaching you experience and practice. You'll sort of get that stuff afterward. Starting to think about that while being in law school, I think, is a very important set of skills. It enables students to take ownership over their careers from a very early time. I'd also think that students should be exposed to other ways of thinking in other fields. I think multidisciplinary legal education has become very important. And when you're part of a university, as students here in Arkansas or students at Northwestern are, take advantage of the opportunities presented by a research university that has many facets and many parts. Demand of your professors that they give you perspectives not only on legal doctrine, as important as that is, mm-hmm. but how legal doctrine intersects with business and intersects with technology. That to me is the single biggest change that's happened in the last few years, wherever you're at law school, is the necessity, the imperative of our graduates of our law schools, to be able to hit the ground running to work at the intersection of law, business, and technology. You can do that a lot of different ways. There's not one size fits all. Folks, students will go into different kinds of legal practice, but having those kinds of skills that they can develop in law school, I think, is a very, very important aim.
That's fantastic. Thank you for that.
Sure.
And thanks for your time. I'm glad you're here.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you. I've enjoyed my time here. I'm looking forward to the lecture, and thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
For more information on Conversations with the Legal Academy, show notes, and additional episodes, go to law.uark.edu/podcast. Or you can find us at kuaf.com under the local and podcast link. You can also listen to episodes or subscribe through iTunes or with your favorite podcast app. If you enjoy the show, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts, which will help others find us. Music for Conversations with the Legal Academy was written and performed by Josh Woodward. To keep up with us between episodes, follow the University of Arkansas School of Law on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for UARKLAW. That's UARKLAW. Thank you for listening.